So I'm not really sure how people start these things. I'm just, I guess, going to give you a brief introduction to, or just a little bit of my background. Just one or two lines, and then we'll get started. I'm Shauna Dillavu, obviously. I am a researcher based in D.C. I work on Latin America generally, but Mexico specifically. And inside of Mexico, I look at political issues, crime and security, obviously, and then technology and its intersections with those things. So I might look at how social media is being used in the 2012, in the elections in July in Mexico, and also a topic like this. A few things before we get started. There are going to be pretty grisly images in this presentation. It's Mexico. I mean, that's sort of part of, that's par for the course. But also, you know, I went back and forth about this, like, was it going to be too much to have some of these images? And I felt like I would be doing a disservice to the people who are suffering with this and struggling with this every day if I did anything to sugarcoat what they're going through. So if that's bothersome to you, you know, I'll understand if you need to step out. Or if you want to use that as an excuse, if it's like, ah, oh, boring, you could step out acting like it's the images. Secondly, this is a pretty tiny room and we're not that many people, so feel free to ask questions at any point. I would prefer this be more like a conversation than me lecturing for 45 minutes, because while I love the sound of my own voice, I can't imagine everyone in this room does. And finally, and I guess this gets more to the presentation itself, this is more of an explanation of how and not necessarily why. I don't claim to know why drug cartels do what they do, and I would caution anyone who's, you know, I caution you that if anyone told you they did, to take that with a grain of salt. I think the only people who understand why things happen the way they do are people that are on the inside and pretty high up, and they sure as hell aren't talking about it. Not with anybody like me. So, if there are no other questions, I'll just jump in, get started. Okay. So drug traffickers, I hate it when people start presentations like discussing their title slide, but I feel like I need to do this just because I think this needs a bit of clarification, because I'm going to use the term drug trafficker and cartel, sort of all these terms sort of interchangeably, but there are differences in these terms. So drug trafficker I think I used because it was the most descriptive inside of the character count for the title of the presentation. But it's not exactly accurate, and neither is cartel for that matter. Cartels they started to use, I think, back in the Colombia cocaine days when the Medellin and the Cali cartels were running, you know, well, I think that the agents that I've spoken to, and this is anecdotal, that were working then, they used cartel because those cartels, the Medellin and Cali cartels, were running everything from cultivation of coke to production of it to trafficking and distribution and sale of it. So it was more like that vertical part of the industry, like that vertical industry sort of idea. They applied cartel to that. But a cartel is a combination of independent enterprises that are designed to limit competition and fix prices. Obviously, it's an economic descriptor, right? So it doesn't really apply to our guys in Mexico. More like I said, the guys in Colombia. And so when when interdiction efforts shut down the trafficking route from through the Caribbean up to South Florida, think back to Miami Vice, things moved over to Mexico then, and they were really, the guys that were there operating were really just traffickers. So they started calling them drug trafficking organizations, or DTOs. But like I said, that's not entirely accurate either. It was, I think, the middle of last year that major federal agencies like DHS and DOD, parts of them, and states started calling these groups transnational criminal organizations, or transnational criminal networks, TCOs or TCNs. And I think that's a little more descriptive because these guys don't just traffic in drugs. They have a pretty diverse portfolio, which I'll get into in a minute. And it also, some would argue, heightens the threat assessment for these groups, particularly to U.S. national security. Like I said, I'm going to use these terms pretty interchangeably, even though now we know they all mean different things. I'll probably use cartel because it's only two syllables, vice three. It doesn't really matter in any event what we call them, because their mission and vision is essentially the same. These cartels are sophisticated, complex organizations with specialized functions and compartmentalized roles, and they use advanced security and communications techniques. They're a lot like multinational corporations in that they have operations literally in every corner of the globe. They might move drugs that are cultivated in South Asia or South America. They might get precursors for meth, say, from Southeast Asia. They work with traffickers in West Africa, Nigeria particularly, and they sell drugs to Australia, to Europe, and to the United States. Other parts of North America, not forgetting Canada. Like I mentioned, they have really diverse portfolios. So the typical sort of drugs and thugs stuff, they move drugs, they move arms, they launder money. But these guys also traffic in humans, particularly undocumented folks from Central America coming up through Mexico to the United States. But they also extort and kidnap and run prostitution rings and pornography stuff, and they even sell contraband like pirated DVDs. And they're sort of into everything. Some groups are really hierarchical, like the Sinaloa cartel on the Pacific coast, and they prefer to co-opt the public to be their lookouts or their intel network or their recruits, or for whatever reason, by buying them food or building them churches or stadiums. Others, like the Zetas that we'll get into in more detail in this conversation, and the Gulf cartel before them, operate in sort of a cellular network-style fashion, a lot like Al-Qaeda. And they prefer violence as a motivator for the public, the press, to control their own members, and to secure smuggling routes and territories, as we're about to see. So, forgive me, I'm not so good on the slides. It's sort of coordination's tough for me. So jumping right in. On September 13th, 2011, in Nuevo Laredo, just across the border from Laredo, Texas, two 20-something kids were found dead, hanging from an overpass, half-naked, disemboweled, with deep lacerations, and other obvious signs of torture. Two messages were left with the bodies, which is pretty typical in these sort of murders. They call them narco messages or narco mensajes. The first was attached to the male victim's leg, and it read, "This happened for snitching on Frontera Rojo Vivo," which is, Frontera Rojo Vivo is one of the internet forums used in Nuevo Laredo for citizens to report on cartel activity, and I'll explain that and others in a bit. Let's see. The second one read, "This will happen to all internet snitches," and it lists a couple of sites that they use: Frontera Rojo Vivo, Blog del Narco, and Denuncia Ciudadana. "Be warned," it says, "we've got our eye on you," and it's signed with a Z, which is supposed to mean Zetas. Ultimately, it's not clear who these victims were, if they were actual commenters on the blog, or if they ever used those blogs, or if they were just related to the Zetas in some way and they didn't like them, or if they were from a rival group, or if they were just random passersby, just kids on the street that they took to be easy targets. But what is clear is that this message was directed at any of these people using social network sites, like these social media, these sites, to report cartel activity. 11 days later, on September 24th, the headless corpse of Maria Elizabeth Macias, who was a blog reporter and an administrator known as La Nena de Laredo, so the girl from Laredo, on the Nuevo Laredo en Vivo Forum, another reporting site in Nuevo Laredo, was dumped in front of a monument on a major thoroughfare in Nuevo Laredo. Her head, along with headphones and computer equipment, was found atop this street planter. You can see it there. And her body was stripped and showed signs of torture. Not shockingly, there was a note, a narco mensaje. And like before, it threatened people using these social media sites to anonymously report crime. It said, "Okay, Nuevo Laredo en Vivo, and social media sites. I am La Nena de Laredo, and I'm here because of my online reports and yours. This is for those who don't believe this happened to me because of my actions, for trusting in the Army and the Marines. Thank you for your attention, La Nena de Laredo." And then there are the Z's again, which again indicate the Zetas. Initially, it wasn't clear if this was actually her body. They weren't like public. They didn't publicly state that it was or wasn't until the blog came out saying that she, in fact, was theirs. Finally, 6 weeks later, early on November 9th, 2011, the decapitated body of a male, identified publicly here by his handle, Rascatripas, which means belly scratcher, was found at the same monument in Nuevo Laredo as La Nena. The message left with his body and held down by the man's head, as you can see in that one, and then blurred out here, how tasteful, identified him as a moderator on Nuevo Laredo en Vivo. "Hello, I'm Rascatripas," it says, "and this happened to me for failing to understand that I should not report things on social media sites." And it goes on to say there are things, but it's hard to read it because of the blood. And it's signed Rascatripas. Moderators at Nuevo Laredo en Vivo, where he was supposed to have been a blogger, later announced that he was not one of their collaborators, but was a scapegoat whose murder served to intimidate contributors from denouncing on the blog. So after the spate of murders, all obviously having to do with these citizen reporting sites in Nuevo Laredo, I had to wonder why, obviously. Wouldn't be a very good researcher if I didn't. And why this place? Was it something about Nuevo Laredo, I thought? And was it something about what was happening there that made this happen there? Next slides. Okay. Come on, buddy. There we go. So before I get started talking about Nuevo Laredo, I guess there's one thing in my research that I kept coming up on, and I think it's a really important drug trafficking term that I need to explain, and it's plaza. And plaza, we all know what a plaza is, right? Like, it's like an outdoor, it's like a place in the center of the city with outdoor cafes and music and dancing and children and da-da-da. That's what you think of as plaza, obviously. This is a very different plaza. Many simply translate plaza in the drug trafficking sense as a trafficking route. But that ignores the complex historical and corporate implications of the term. Historically, the term in Mexico was used to mark the jurisdiction of a particular police authority. And anybody who knows anything about Mexico knows that there are a gajillion different sorts of police at all the levels. So like local, municipal, state, and federal levels. There's tons of police operations, which just makes things easier. It also tends to be where everything is concentrated. It's like a node, right, in the drug trafficking term. Drug trafficking sense. It's where the high human capital is based. It's where the heads of kidnapping and prostitution and assassination rings are. It's where the orders come from. I mean, being a blog or being a plaza boss is a big deal. So it's a valuable piece of real estate on a particular trafficking corridor. And that's why we see them a lot on the borders. So on the north and south borders of Mexico and on the seaports like Acapulco, Veracruz, and even inland in the more major cities like Monterrey and Mexico City. So at first glance, this seems to fit with Nuevo Laredo, nice American accent there. Nuevo Laredo itself only has about 375,000 residents, which is about the size of Wichita, Kansas. So it's not real big, and its metro area is under 1 million people. So it's like, how important could this be? But it is the largest and most important inland port in the Americas. It's got approximately 8,500 trucks that cross the border each day at that point, which turns into 1.5 million in a year, or 5 million cars and 3.8 million pedestrians crossing the four major commercial and rail bridges that are there. Some say 70% of all Mexican exports to the U.S. go through here. Top this off with the strength of the logistics and export sectors in Tamaulipas in general, the major port at Altamira, which you see here, the maquiladoras and the Pemex refineries, and several other border crossings in that state. And what does it seem? That this state and this city specifically are pretty crucial pieces of territory for anybody trying to move anything into the U.S. or throughout the Americas. So given its geographic location, Nuevo Laredo has been an important staging and transshipment point, an important plaza, as we discussed, to move narcotics, people, and contraband to the U.S. It makes sense, then, that there would have been much struggle for the control of this bit of territory among the various drug trafficking operations. Many experts, in fact, call a skirmish in 2004 between the Gulf Cartel and its then armed wing, the Zetas, which we've talked about, and the Sinaloa Cartel from the Pacific Coast for control of this golden smuggling route. They call that the beginning of the current iteration of the drug war. Then President Vicente Fox even sent troops in 2004 or in 2005. And more than 100 people died, which, you know, in terms of how many people have died so far, it doesn't seem like much. But at the time, 100 people died in Nuevo Laredo, and 15 of them were police. So it seems like that might be a place with some interest. The Gulf Cartel was founded by Juan Garcia Abrego as early as the 1920s and was based in Matamoros, Tamaulipas, just giving you a little background on the groups that were there. When Garcia Abrego was apprehended in 1996, a power vacuum ensued, and several top members fought for leadership until this fella, arrow forward, that fine-looking gentleman, Ociel Cárdenas Guillén, took over in 1999. To keep his rivals in the group at bay, let alone to protect himself from rival cartels and the Mexican military, Cárdenas contracted this fella, Arturo Guzmán de Sena, who was an army lieutenant with ties to the Grupo Aeromóvil de Fuerzas Especiales, so the Airborne Special Forces Group. To recruit more than 30 members of the special forces to form that cartel's armed faction known as the Zetas. So this is Fuerzas Especiales de Cartel del Golfo, so Special Forces of the Gulf Cartel. The Zetas were more than a private mercenary army. They ran kidnappings, protection rackets, extortion. They secured places and executed foes, often with grotesque savagery. I mean, they really upped the ante in terms of the nastiness, the grisliness, which was on full display when the Zetas broke with the Gulf Cartel in early 2010 in a battle that rolled through Tamaulipas and neighboring states, killing thousands unofficially, but by unofficial counts, thousands of people and leaving areas of total destruction. It makes sense then that Nuevo Laredo would be the scene to these murders, right? Well, sort of. I mean, Tamaulipas has its share of shit. In June 2010, a gubernatorial candidate by the name of Rodolfo Torre Cantú was killed on the campaign trail by cartel assassins. Later, in August of that year, 72 bodies in San Fernando, Tamaulipas, of undocumented Central Americans were found. They were killed by the Zetas. Unofficial accounts have found that something like 450 bodies were buried in mass graves in Tamaulipas and Durango. And this they started to uncover in April 2011. But violence and gruesome atrocities are not unique to Nuevo Laredo or to Tamaulipas. Just a couple of examples. In January 2010, cartel sicarios killed 13 high school students in Juarez. It's not shocking. It's Juarez, right? That's what you'd expect. Here's three members of a family connected to the U.S. consulate were gunned down on the way home from a child's birthday party. Another party shot up. Something like 18 people killed, and this is in Torreon, July 2010. 51 bodies found in Monterrey, 5 headless bodies, bringing 25 that week found in Acapulco. Probably heard about this last fall, last summer, I guess. In Monterrey, the state just locked a bunch of people inside of a casino and burned it, killing everyone inside. And in Veracruz in September, something like 35 bodies were found, just dumped on a major thoroughfare or a major freeway in the morning. So Nuevo Laredo might be a plaza with lots of history of fighting, but it's not the geographic location alone that brought this on. Haha, Straffer. This gives you an idea of the current picture, the Straffer map from January 2011, or 2012, sorry. So in fact, there are something like 7 to 12 groups that are operating in Mexico, and this is a figure that ebbs and flows with interdiction efforts, splintering some groups or emboldening other groups, and rivals vying for plazas, and ultimately for a larger share of a pie that's estimated to be to bring in between 18 and 39 billion a year, which, I mean, is a huge range, but it's still a lot of money. Some 50,000 have died in the fighting. Oh, I guess I have these stats laid out. Some 50,000 have died in the fighting since 2006, which is on par with what we lost in Vietnam. And another 5,000 have disappeared. So if not geography, then maybe it's the sites mentioned in the narco messages. This is my deductive reasoning as a researcher. This is how I get paid the big bucks. Turns out, Nuevo Laredo is pretty evolved in its level of citizen involvement in social media, unlike most other places in Mexico, it seems. The civic participation seems to be filling the void left by a lack of journalism in Mexico. Mexico is among the very worst places to be a journalist. Little known fact, it's literally on par with Afghanistan, Libya, and Iraq in 2011. The number of assassinations recorded last year ranged from 3 to 13, and I'll explain why that's such a range. But my brief review of just a few media sites from, I think, the last half of 2011 yielded 6 folks, 6 different journalists that were killed. But why, you ask, are journalists a target? Well, obviously, cartels, in an effort to silence reporting on their operations, beat, kidnap, and murder journalists. They throw grenades and Molotov cocktails, they start fires, and they shoot at news headquarters as a means of intimidation. As this award-winning journalist, Javier Arturo Valdez Cardena, said, "When I'm writing, I'm not thinking about my wife, the editor, the reader. I'm writing and I'm thinking about the narco, as if he were behind me, watching as I write." More chillingly, Mexican officials seem complicit with these assassinations and are often unwilling to allow these murders to be recorded as direct reprisals for the victim's work as a journalist, which is why that range of 3 to 13. For example, Ana Maria Marcela Yarse Viveros and Rocio González Trapaga were found brutally murdered, their bodies covered by a plastic sheet in a park in Mexico City on August 31st, 2011. Yarsib is the founder of Contralinea, which is a weekly investigative news magazine, and González Trabaga was a freelance reporter formerly of Televisa. Mexico City Attorney General, who's actually running for mayor of Mexico City on the PRD ticket this year, Miguel Ángel Mancera, asserted that the motive for the killings was simply robbery. That's all he would hear about. That's laughable, isn't it? Yolanda Ordaz de la Cruz is a crime reporter at Notiver in Veracruz, and she was found dead on July 27, 2011, 3 days after being kidnapped. Though officials suspected organized crime was responsible for the murder of Ordaz, who was found with her throat cut. As is often the case, they denied that she was killed for her work. All told, Mexico's National Commission on Human Rights puts the number of journalists killed at 70 since 2000. And in the same period, the number of disappeared stands at 13, which is by far the highest worldwide. Though most are feared dead, those that are returned, like this fella, Alejandro Hernández Pacheco, was a cameraman for Televisa who was kidnapped by the Zetas, flee out of fear. Hernández Pacheco became the second Mexican reporter to receive asylum to the U.S. on August 29, 2010. So it's no wonder that the trend for Mexican journalists has become self-censorship and adhering to the guidance of cartels when writing or printing. Last September, following the murder of a photography intern at El Diario de Juárez, the staff published an editorial that directly asked the cartels, "You all are the de facto authority here. Tell us what you want us to do so that no more are killed." And it's well documented that back in Tamaulipas, the Gulf cartel and the Zetas demand that only information that is approved by them be published. Disobeying that order could mean death, obviously, as we've seen. So it makes sense that it might be the place where the citizen network of communication might have grown up the strongest, given that bit of evidence. Like many people in border towns, folks in Nuevo Laredo were initially simply trying to survive, to get themselves to work and home alive each day. What started as mass emails and posts on community online bulletin boards evolved, taking advantage of platforms like Facebook and Twitter, before growing into the things that we've already mentioned, Al Rojo Vivo and Nuevo Laredo en Vivo. This evolution is apparent as the citizen use of these social media sites is now more of an active response to the narco use of social media, creating, in a sense, a public conversation between the two groups online, which is virtually the only place that a conversation like that could be possible. So then I guess we have to figure out what the cartels are saying and maybe give a why. Cartels use social media for several reasons. First of all, as is their motivation for shutting down the traditional media, they seek to control information. They want to track the movements of rival groups, of the military, of the federales, while silencing efforts to track them and inform on them. For example, to control the public, cartels often use fear. Not shocking. This is a key tool to extort the public, to co-opt them, to recruit them. YouTube is key for creating fear and is by far the most compelling and direct method of communication given the visual images, which in Mexico are notoriously violent. For example, it also has incredible reach, given that it is the third most popular site in all of Mexico. So take, for example, this video from September 2011 where two guys are getting their heads cut off, this one with a chainsaw, and I mean this, the other less mercifully with a knife, for working for a rival cartel. I mean, they were working for the Sinaloa cartel. I think they were getting paid 300 pesos a month, 25 bucks, and this is their fate. It was so graphic that YouTube took it down. That's why I found it at a different place. So I have no idea how many viewers it had. But there are tons of videos of people's reactions to the video and other that offer methods for finding the video hosted elsewhere, like this Bestscore, which is a disgusting site. This bothers you? I wouldn't go there. Hosted elsewhere. Like this one that has 10,000 likes on Facebook. Yeah. Maybe more frightening is the social influence these videos have. As far back as 2007, I found a dozen or more videos of kids playing that they're narcos. This might speak more to the soft power or the indirect messaging of these groups, which I'll get to more in a bit. Blogs also post photos of narcomantas. Narcomantas are signs that are usually bearing hand-painted messages. They're from a cartel that are hung in a public place to communicate with the public or a rival group or the government or law enforcement. Narcomantas are most often used, I would say, by cartels to win the public favor by offering protection, referring to themselves as the true provider of the people, since the state's faltering at that, or pinning the blame on, for violence on rival groups. They may also outrightly recruit the public, which we'll see later in the presentation. Thanks to this, the infamous Blog del Narco, set up in March 2010, narco blogs became another method of direct communication from the cartels to the public. Because Blog del Narco operates on the principle that it does not discriminate in content, nor by its submitter of content, anything gets posted, no matter if it comes from a cartel, or the police, or an average citizen. This means that the blog provides space for cartels to speak directly to the public, as was the case in one of Blog del Narco's first postings, which was a letter, an open letter from the cartel coalition, La Nueva Federación, specifically to the people of Reynosa and Monterrey, telling them not to worry, that the fighting in their cities was simply a rearrangement, as they sought to remove the Zetas from those states. And this was back in March 2010 when the Zetas were breaking off from the Gulf cartel. Blog del Narco also provides information that is censored in traditional media or that just isn't in the press at all. Like this case in July 2010, when a video of an interrogation by the Zetas of a 25-year-old policeman from Durango named Rodolfo Najera blew the lid off an alliance between the prison warden, a nearby prison warden named Margarita Rojas Rodriguez, and the Sinaloa cartel. Rojas, who headed the Gómez Palacio prison near Torreón, Coahuila, released inmates that were Sinaloa cartel sicarios, they were assassins, gave them guns and cars, and sent them off to commit murders at night and brought them back in the day. That was the arrangement. By August 2010, just 6 months after it was launched, Blog del Narco was getting 3 million hits a week, and hundreds of items were posted a day. I'll get more into its analytics later in the presentation, but Blog del Narco changed the game by letting anyone submit. If that trend hasn't already taken hold among the dozens of other narco blogs, at least not publicly, it likely will have to. Because apparently, giving the narcos a platform is key to survival. Cartels also make use of the soft power of narco-glam on Facebook profiles, which idealize the life, you know, and make recruitment efforts all among the young all the easier. Not to mention that Facebook, the second most popular site in all of Mexico, has inevitable reach, particularly with young. The glorification of the narco life is all over Facebook. Pages dedicated to the often banned narco corridos, which are like the narco ballads, garnered hundreds of thousands of fans. This one page had 150,000, and it just was a page of people liking it. I didn't see any content, like there were no narco corridos or anything on there. Apparently they're real popular. There are also pages devoted to narco saints like the Santa Muerte and Jesus Malverde, AK-47s, or the so-called cuernos de chivo, the goat horns, because of the roundy part here. Narco cinema sites, and they even had apps for narco gifts, which would have been killer swag for this presentation. Next time. I'm going to make a note about that. Profiles abound with photos of gold-clad guns, busty chicks, trocas like this one, motorcycles, and information about buying and selling guns, growing and moving drugs, and how cool it is to be part of one group or another. That's the soft influence on Facebook, but Facebook also makes it easy for virtual kidnappings. Virtual kidnappings are when a call is made saying, you know, we have your daughter or something, and you have to pay us by this amount of, like, in a very short period of time. So the family doesn't have time to verify that this girl or their child has been actually taken. That's a virtual kidnapping. There are many kinds of kidnapping in Mexico. But so it makes virtual kidnapping targets all the easier because there are a lot of pages that are left too open and populated with too much personal information that can make it really convincing for families of alleged victims. Last but not least, Twitter, it turns out, is a pretty good method of collecting intel, too. In April 2011, agents found a Twitter account attached to a smartphone that a suspect was arrested with in Guadalupe, Nuevo León. Looking into the account, they found that it was falsified because his name was not Melissa Lotzer. And this handle, Track Monterrey, was attached to Melissa Lotzer's account. So this account was set up to act as a concerned citizen encouraging others to report shootouts and other movements of organized crime at these hashtags, at Águilas Monterrey and Monterrey Follow. You can see some of them here. It's not the first instance of cartels using social media to spy on their enemies, you know, using Twitter to, like, find out where people are, but it was the first discovery of them actually soliciting it. Cartels had been using smartphones, Nextel phones, working in cyber cafes, whatever, to observe concerned citizen handles, like this Monterrey Follow would be one of them, or people would, or Veracruz Follow, there's others. So they would do that, converting these concerned citizens into what they called halcones, or falcons is the English, it means lookout. But Twitter's also been used to create rumors of shootouts and confrontations that have caused civic leaders to shut down schools, as was the case in 20 cities in Nayarit, the state of Nayarit, in June 2010. Or when in September 2011 in Veracruz, a retweet of a threat that a child would be killed for every cartel member killed at one of these concerned citizen handles, at Ver Follow, like Veracruz Follow, made all hell break loose in that town. While in neither case is it clear that cartels were at fault, it would be an easy tool for them to create chaos because of what Andres Monroy Hernandez calls a weak information immune system. But how deeply, then, are these messages actually penetrating Mexican society? Because they can talk all they want, but if no one's listening, and it's not really making a bit of difference, like, what difference does it make? Well, let's start answering that by looking at the number of people actually getting online, which is not a lot in Mexico. Only about 35 million as of September 2011. That's only 31% of the population. Not surprisingly, 50% of internet users are between the ages of 12 and 24, and another 10% between the ages of 6 and 11. So 60% of the people online in Mexico are under the age of 25. More than a quarter of internet users reside in Mexico City and Mexico State, and here are a couple of other nodes where there are more. 87% of people, of internet users, or internautas as they're called in Spanish, connect at home. More significantly, though, is that 57% connect through a cell or a smartphone. And that's a number that's on the rise, boosting internet usage overall, especially among social media platforms. So most social media studies put the number of internautas using social media between 61 and 77%, let's just say 25 million Mexicans. Facebook is the most popular social media site, it's sort of a no duh. And then there's YouTube, as you see, and Twitter. But these are just raw statistics. Not really, they give us a decent jumping off point, but they're not exactly going to paint a complete picture of how far these cartel messages reach. So to fill in some of those blanks, let's look at a couple of proxies, like analytics for some of the popular narco blogs in Mexico, or the possibility of these narco videos going viral. And even looking at the repetition of narcomantas using a Google image search. So first, the analyticals. Alexa, which I'm sure most of you are familiar with, is a free global analytics website. Where am I in my notes? Okay. Well, it keeps numbers on site traffic and ranking and reach and reputation. And applied to narco blogs, it's not surprising that Blog del Narco comes out on top. A little bit of an anomaly here that I have to explain. Blog del Narco's administrators were forced by the government to move their URL. I've never heard of that being, for security reasons, they said, I've never heard of that being a security thing. I don't know if anyone in here is familiar with another case that's like that. So they just moved it back to Blog del Narco, just obviously in February, so you can see a huge spike there. So its rank isn't very high in Mexico. It's at 333. But I reckon that in a couple of months when this evens out, you'll see that rank go up. But what's more impressive is that they have quite a bit of, I mean, the reputation. They have a lot of sites linking into them. So that's pretty good for a blog. I mean, the Nuevo Laredo newspaper El Mañana has like 958 sites linking into it. So it's got a bit more reach. Obviously, it's a national platform. And as you can see, compared to other narco blogs, it's sort of a far better thing. So Blog del Narco, which allows postings from all sides, cartel dudes included, may have more reach than, say, Mundo Narco, which only has 300 sites linking to it. And Mundo Narco we chose because it's what is linked to by Nuevo Laredo en Vivo, so like the citizen site chose them. So we can't be sure that even, you know, like Blog del Narco, cartel dudes post stuff, but we can't be sure that many or even, you know, any of the posts are coming from Narco, so this isn't going to paint much of a complete picture either. Videos, as we know, are by far the most evocative method of communication between the narcos and the public. Nothing says, don't do that, like seeing a dude get his head taken off. But measuring their reach is more complex than simply looking at the number of views of a video, because obviously those numbers aren't necessarily all Mexicans or unique visitors, for that matter. So I reviewed some popular cartel videos through the filter of what makes a video viral. So I use things like viewership, longevity of interest, let's see what else, whether parody or spinoff, whether those videos were available, and if there was buzz about the video. As I mentioned before, videos of interrogations and live executions are among the most viewed. Mexican culture seems to have a really morbid fascination. One video that got more than 10 million views since its uploading in April 2009 is the confession and subsequent execution of a couple of Zetas. Though censored by YouTube, the graphic material is still available. I think you can see in the comments, maybe the screenshot's not so good, that there are directions for finding it. Nonetheless, this is a spin-off video. It's like a video minus one execution of the four that happened. So this spin-off video, let's say, has 3,000 comments. Maybe you can see there at the bottom, 2,990-something. And some were posted as recently as a few days ago. So this, in a sense, displays parity and viewership, obviously, and longevity. Remember that chainsaw beheading that I showed you a second ago? Others posted video of their reactions to it, since the video itself was no longer available. And there were parodies by the young kids again. And the video is still being mentioned in blog posts. I mean, it was sort of a benchmark of cruelty available online for viewing. So in addition to views, it has parody and buzz. Aside from individual viral videos, Blog del Narco's YouTube channel may provide a bit of insight. In the year and a half since it's been up, only 39 videos have been loaded. Nonetheless, the channel has 12.2 million views. And almost 13,000 subscribers, which that seems like a lot, but like, what's your benchmark or your baseline? I then looked to see what the president's or the federal government's channel had. And they've been up for almost 6 years, so like since December of 2006, and they have fewer views, 9 million and 10,000 subscribers, which is only shocking when you realize they have 3,700 videos loaded. Yeah. I didn't look at that. I just assumed that you couldn't. I guess I'm showing my ignorance with that. Does anyone know if there's a way to do that? It's a very simple, like, YouTube thing. You just can't be an idiot like me, researcher. Yes. It's simple. Awesome. Awesome. Thanks. Learning and teaching. My favorite combination. Okay. Where am I? Chainsaw. Okay. Any other questions about this for the moment? Okay. Launching back in. Oh, yeah. Okay. Finally, I used a Google image search to see how widely images of the infamous narcomantas were disseminated. By their nature, narcomantas are hung with the expectation that they'll reach a far wider audience than the locale that they're posted in. So I tried out a couple of different mantas, like this one from March 2011, where the Carteles Unidos, which is a supposed alliance of cartels, reached out to the Calderon administration, so you can see there, asking them to join forces with this alliance to fight against the Zetas via this narcomanta that was hung at Reynosa, Tamaulipas. The narco message had some reach. The Googles returned some 39 results, and you know, a dozen distinct narco blogs and other alternative news sources in Mexico. But the big whammy was this narcomanta hung in Nuevo Laredo back in April 2008. So it's been around a bit longer. But it is recruiting military or ex-military guys to the Zetas with the promise that no longer will you have to eat instant noodles and leaving a phone number. So clearly the military isn't treated all that well. And they operate with enough impunity, or they think they do, that they could just post a phone number. So it's this direct message to the public has been reposted on over 100 sites. That's what the results returned. Again, it's been around for a bit longer, but it seems like a pretty effective recruiting tool. So what effect has this messaging had on the public? Like I said, back in Nuevo Laredo, citizens turned first to electronic communication in the early 2000s simply to survive, to protect themselves from the very real danger of simply being in the wrong place at the wrong time. Now citizens Now citizen reporting has become much more sophisticated and much more about organizing and fighting back. With some help from a major news group, sites have even set up that have been set up that channel and map citizen reporting in real time. And that's the Nuevo Laredo en Vivo, the site made famous by the blogger killings. It crowdsources a real-time map of shootouts, of blockades, and cartel and law enforcement movements, and it sends out alerts. Nuevo Laredo en Vivo is not the only site to offer that package of tools. Frontera Rojo Vivo, set up by the Reforma... Oh, wait, no, I just wanted to mention one more thing about that. Just as importantly, Nuevo Laredo en Vivo provides methods for anonymously making complaints to government security forces. It offers users tools and training for protecting themselves online, like how to use anonymizers. It has guidance for using a Tor router and other tips for eliminating one's online footprint. It also provides chat rooms for people to comment about security issues in a portal, the Mundo Narco portal, to inform themselves. But it's not the only one, as I was saying. Frontera Rojo Vivo, set up by the Reforma news conglomerate, allows users to report or comment on things pertinent to specific border states or municipalities. If you can see here, they've got the states listed out here. Nuevo León, Tamaulipas, Coahuila, and inside, you can make comments about different cities. The major daily, El Universal, also created a crowdsourced map showing locations of crime in Mexico City. Narco blogs, in addition to encouraging internautas to report, offer chat spaces for citizens to network with one another at a local or a national level, which are important for a couple of reasons. First, they can be a great place for users to help one another verify the veracity of posts, of photos, and tweets, and clarify disinformation. More savvy internautas have developed their own systems for evaluating veracity. Sharing that and other helpful OPSEC tools among trusted users is key to helping protect one another. These chat rooms can also be a great place for emotional support and encouragement to continue reporting, which is really important. Following the murders of the Nuevo Laredo bloggers, one commenter on the Arrojo Vivo forum wrote, "Don't be afraid to denounce. It's very difficult for them to know who denounced. They only want to scare society." Facebook and Twitter also offer a space for citizens to warn one another, to share information, to discuss security issues or news, and to encourage one another further. There are also myriad online movements, many of them that start on Facebook, for example, that move offline. This one, No Más Sangre, No More Blood, is one of them. But if the Mexican internautas want to continue to fight back, they've got their work cut out for them. Let me see if we can advance the slide here. That's how good I'm with technology. Because cartels turning to Twitter as an intel network is just the beginning. They're going to get more sophisticated in their use of technology and more aggressive going forward. First of all, there have been reports of cartels recruiting computer programming students out of universities against their will. Like this guy, Ernesto Villegas Alvarez, who in July 2011 found himself working for the drug lord La Barbie. Didn't know that's the assignment he was getting when he went to Acapulco and then couldn't get out. There have been numerous accounts of abductions of cell phone network technicians, at least 13, in northeastern Mexico alone in the last 2 years. And a group of Nextel technicians who were taken in 2009 are reportedly still being forced to work for the cartels. This sort of recruitment doesn't seem too beyond the pale. Cartel hitmen, the ones that I keep calling sicarios, are regularly put through college or police academies by the cartel. So they're not dummies, you know, they're well-trained. Like I said, it's a pretty sophisticated machine. In fact, it seems plausible that the cartels are likely sending their own guys to school now, and this is more of a stopgap, these sort of like abducting these guys until their fellows graduate. Experts have even suggested that cartels are looking to cybercrime to expand their business, because the potential profits of cybercrime would make it possible for them to make more money with less risk. With their established criminal networks already in place, it wouldn't be much of a reach. Add to this a series of busts in late 2011, this blows my mind, that brought down a transnational private communications network stretching from Honduras deep into Texas that the state has built and operated to coordinate shipments, to monitor rivals, orchestrate attacks, whatever. It is completely independent of commercial channels, which translates to they are squarely outside of the reach of law enforcement. You can't wiretap this. Yeah. They didn't even know it existed. All told, soldiers see something like 167 antennas, 150 repeaters, and thousands of cell phones and radios set up to operate on the system. So going forward, what's to be done? And how can we get involved? Obviously, there's a lot of work to do here on safety for the citizen reporters. There are a lot of opportunities, I think, for tech folks and NGOs or activists to team up. One of the things the online activists in Mexico say in response to cartels building intel networks off their tweets is that you can't close hashtags. Well, obviously, that's not how Twitter works, but is there a way that we can make these tweets or some other sort of thing similar to that public-ish and still safe? Like, or is it, or are there some other sort of network or mesh networks that can be created to make this public yet private-ish? Yeah. Could something like that be possible in an app, something that maybe would piggyback or work in combination with Twitter that would ensure a safer network for reporting while maintaining access and mobility? Maybe more on the NGO programming side, how can we build off of what already exists in Mexico to evaluate trustworthiness? Because that's a huge issue. You can build all the apps you want to, but the bad guys can still use them. You know, like these guys, I was looking at different apps in the States, like Crime Push is one that you can use in D.C. Not a bad idea. This is one from the West Virginia DHS where you can anonymously report crimes that are happening, which is great. But what's to stop bad guys from doing that to, you know, to misinform? I think the key there is that, you know, we already have folks in Mexico that are developing their own evaluation tools for veracity. What can we do to help further that and to share that information throughout Mexico? Obviously, OPSEC tools like anonymizers and routers have got to get into the hands of the people who are there. Providing training for them to continue the fight is an absolute must. I mean, we already see this outside support in China and Iran and in lots of other places where it's just as oppressive. Why not here, too? I've mentioned a lot of chat spaces and existing reporting sites or mechanisms and wondered, are they too Byzantine and disconnected? Or does that make it safer that they're like that? Would it make sense to connect things so people can connect with one another and build a network for their own safety? Or is that going to create more harm? And a colleague of mine suggested lawful intercept. And I guess that gets into a more of a macro issue, because I can't see how it would be applied in this situation. It assumes working, trustworthy government agencies in place to monitor and promote the work of what would have to be private companies doing the intercept, right? But I just can't see how one or another corrupt official just won't pass on whatever intel they come across about, you know, whatever cartel kingpin that they're watching and share it with that guy. This gets into, like I said, much more of a macro discussion about corruption and transparency efforts from the top all the way down to, like, the local police officer. I mean, how do we then... This would not work unless we have some international NGO pressure or other pressure on Mexico towards cleaning up its corruption and transparency. And how do we raise awareness in the U.S. about the online activism that's going on in Mexico to help their grassroots efforts, especially if the popular culture and knowledge on this side of the border is of a country of, you know, spring break, and Mexico keeps up with its tourism campaigns. I mean, I was in a session yesterday where they mentioned that they have four U.S. PR firms that are working to promote their tourism brand all the time in the States. Those are larger questions. If there are law enforcement folks in the room, this is a really... This could be a group that could really take a page from this research. If you're in law enforcement, social media can be a really helpful tool for taking down your targets without having to get a subpoena or a search warrant. It was the girlfriend, this hot commodity right here, of the kingpin El JJ, Juliana Sosa Torro, who ultimately got him caught by posting where she lived on Facebook, and they knew that the two of them lived together. All over Facebook are dudes like this idiot who posts his pot plants growing, like, in phases, like a science experiment. He also says where he lives in the U.S. and where he lives in Mexico, where he's from in Mexico, and he identifies family members that he chats back and forth with on comments on his photos. Then he stands in front of his big old truck with the entire license plate showing. And I'm just like, this is a low-hanging fruit, fella. Like, they don't even have to get a search warrant for this information. If that interests you, come talk to me about what our company, plus this experts network, does. All right, and that's it for me. If you guys have any questions, we got 10 minutes. Yeah?
Is there any conversation about legalization?
I have that one prepared. I mean, is there conversation? That's like one of two. Is there any conversation in Mexico? Yeah, I mean, about legalizing in Mexico, but I think that overall people always want to know about legalization in the States. And I will give you my thoughts on that, just very briefly. I think legalization begs... Look, the U.S. is the number one consumer of drugs in the world. So it makes sense that the guys next door would be taking advantage of that. I mean, somebody's going to have to, right? As long as we keep consuming. Legalization, I think you'd have to consider that you'd have to pan-legalize drugs. And while I can see some states and eventually the entire U.S. even, at some point in my lifetime, legalizing pot, I don't see them legalizing heroin or cocaine. And you can't have just one. I mean, if you legalize marijuana, then U.S. growers start growing it, and then it's cheaper, and the Mexicans just get out of it. I mean, then they'll be like, fine, we'll just move coke or we'll move other drugs in, because that's a higher margin of profit. Similarly, like, and I think this gets the real point, their portfolio is way too diverse at this point. Like, you can take drugs out, but they'll fill it with something else. And it's probably something far more nefarious. I mean, child porn, or cybercrime, or any number of things that they can do. So you can take that part out, you know, eventually, but I think that they'll still exist. Yeah?
Have you looked at Colombia, and specifically, you know, how Calderon basically defeated the FARC? As far as I know, I mean, that war was basically won by the Colombian government. So
with a lot of help from the U.S.
Right, and so is that... Then that
they're very different scenarios. I mean, it's... You had two cartels working in Colombia, and they're not gone. They're still there. They're just beaten way back. And they used a strategy of what they call decapitation, just taking out the cartel kingpin, right? Taking out the head of the cartel, and then the rest of it would fall apart because they were very hierarchical in structure. That's not the case in Mexico. You don't have just two groups, and a lot of them that are well, there's just only a few that are hierarchical and really just Sinaloa cartel. And you can take out El Chapo, but no one can find him. They haven't been able to find him in like 6 years, you know? Like, I don't think that's going to happen. And even if they did, things I think are a little too cellular at this point. It's going to be too difficult to have that same strategy. The other thing that begs is that...
The French did that in Algeria in 1949. I mean, there was a very effective cellular structure in Algeria.
Mm-hmm.
I forget the name of the guy who was basically the top of the Algerian... resistance, and you know, whilst that's a very different situation, I think, because the morality was on the other side.
Yeah.
But if you put that to one side, just look at military tactics.
Uh-huh.
They rolled up the cells.
Right, and I don't. I mean, I would never argue that Mexico could do something similar. I'm not familiar with that case, so I can't say, you know, 100%. But it also begs that Mexico, like I said, has a functioning security force and like a functioning judicial system. It would take a lot of help from the U.S., much like this case sounds like the French helped out a bunch, and we're just not interested. I was in a briefing last week with some brigadier general from the DOD, and he just didn't care about our Mexico conversation. He was listening, you know, about Iran and about Pakistan and other things, and then we briefed, and he had no questions. People are just not interested at that level of government to make that sort of commitment. Other questions? Yeah.
Uh-huh. There are so many things that you say. I work for the visa.
Ah.
The biggest telecommunication company.
Uh-huh.
I know many journalists. And of course, a lot of things are going on in my country, and many journalists, because it's more than 50,000 deaths in the country. So it is happening. There are many, it's a bigger and bigger problem, because when Obama war, so many arms went into my country, like all of a sudden. And of course, all of this could be used for its own thing.
Yeah.
Many things are happening there. We have many citizens, we have like laws and many things like trying to do different.
Yeah.
People are scared.
But people are very brave. They're so brave to continue reporting even though they're scared, just to get themselves to work in the morning. But please continue.
I wish that you could say also that many good things, and bloggers and tweeters and Facebook from citizens that are trying to do different, of course they're trying to legalize. There was a huge contamination this year. The president of Calderon is going this year. So,
Yeah.
So of course we need help, and we need help us strategies from what can we do as citizens?
Yeah.
We have tools or strategies or laws that you can help us to do better and take
I'm sorry if that wasn't clear. I love Mexico, and I do this. I did this because I wanted to raise awareness in the U.S. about how important that country is, how important to us, like how beautiful it is, and how much we need to help those that are fighting for it. To take it back, to wrest it back from these PTOs, from these drug traffickers. It's so much more than that, and I fear that that message is lost on Americans, that we just think it's like spring break and drugs, and it's so much more. And I, you know, having lived there and spent time with folks that are activists, like I wanted to do something to get the message just a little further out.
Yeah, it's a shame that it's an aspirational thing for you. Because it's too much. And we are very
Let's talk afterwards more. Is that cool? Okay, yeah.
Do you have a sense of why you were talking about now the higher ups in Washington are interested in this whole issue? Do you have a sense of why that's
I mean, I can give you a really glib answer. It's not the sandbox in South Asia or the Middle East. Like, it's, I don't know. It's just not as, it's not as sexy to them. I feel like Latin America has always been that sort of like, it's just like our backyard. We just treat it with contempt at best, you know? And obviously, it's so much more, and it can be so much more to us. And until it becomes like either an economic power or a producer of terrorists, I don't think that we're, that the U.S. government's going to care two licks for it. I saw you first, yeah.
Some of the atrocities that, that you gave us examples of, like Montague and Denver, and I'm trying to circle with, you know, where, why is there an outrage gap? Why isn't more word of this actually making it to NBC, CBS, whatever?
Yeah. I mean, I was in a session yesterday where they're talking about Kony and how like wildly popular it got in a half second, and I was like, why the hell isn't this happening with Mexico? And they're like, well, it's packaging. Like, Kony was packaged for white people in America. And it was like slick PR, and it was done upright, and people jumped on that bandwagon like in a hot second. I don't know. I have a friend, and this is, again, just anecdotal. I have a friend who works at the AP in D.C., and she told me that her colleague that covers Latin America and Mexico doesn't want to write about this anymore. Just is tired of writing about it because it's so hard. And I was like, you son of a bitch. Like, we need you to write about this. This is your job. I have, you know, I can't give you a better answer except that we have work to do if we want to get this message further out there. Yeah.
On that topic of why it's not the U.S. doesn't seem to care as much about can you point to what the difference is between this case versus in Colombia where the U.S. did get involved? Because here it seems like it's much, there's potentially a much more immediate connection.
Yeah, absolutely.
Right now, the, you know, independent of what you believe in the immigration issue, that's huge on the map. It's, you know, people are, I think, gradually, relatively increasingly aware of it, but we're not involved in the war in Colombia, and therefore...
I think Colombia is a different case for a couple of reasons. It happened before the war in Iraq. It happened before 9/11, that we gave all that money to them and we were there helping. And I think also it was a legacy of the war on drugs started essentially with the coke moving up, you know, like that's Miami Vice, all those shows, those things that happened. And so it was like such a... It was such a glamorous drug in the United States until it became the killer of like high-profile people. And then you saw people starting to realize that it wasn't such a good idea. And the war on drugs, and like Reagan, you know, these different presidents like made their careers about that. And that was, I think, solely focused on Colombia and solely on cocaine. Now there are just too many fighting priorities, and quite frankly, in a post 9/11 era, like, that's not a priority. Does that answer your question?
Sort of. Do you think it's related to the, I mean, is the drug trafficking in Mexico less about the sort of sense of glamorous drugs and the minor sharing of methamphetamine?
Right.
Part of it.
It could be part of that. I mean, I don't know, but I could imagine that would be part of it, yeah. that it's not as high profile. I mean, you don't know a lot of celebrities that are doing meth. You only have a few more minutes, so let me take... Yeah, go ahead. Then I'll get you.
Have you looked at sort of like corporate Twitter applications like Yammer as a possible model where
no.
like corporate-grade security admins control who can get into the network as way they try to Twitter like...
Uh-huh.
Mm-hmm.
Great. Let's talk afterwards. Okay, I wanted to answer your question, and then are we done? We'll talk afterwards, okay? I don't follow arms trafficking that much, and I don't know. I think the what I do know about arms trafficking is that a lot comes through the United States, but it's not necessarily... U.S. sellers. I mean, there are a lot of the hormigas, like the little ant sales where people are buying a bunch along the border and moving them across piecemeal. But the larger shipments, I think, are only... The U.S. is a transshipment point. That's my very brief understanding. All right? I guess that's it then, huh? Luis?
Yes.
Okay. Thanks so much, you guys, for your attention. We'll talk afterwards.